Welcome to Behind the Lore, your behind-the-scenes look into the research that it takes to make each episode of Lore Podcast. I'm Allie Steed, and today I'm here with Jenna Rose Nethercott discussing the research she did for episode 223, Worlds Collide. Today, Jenna Rose and I are exploring how power is wielded during witch trials, the slow creep of the Reformation, and if it was worth owning magical books in 999 AD. Your support keeps us going, so once again, we're thrilled to have you here with us. Please join us for a new episode of Behind the Lore. Hi guys, welcome back to Behind the Lore. I am once again here with Jenna Rose Nethercott. Our streak is unbroken. How's it going, Jenna?
It's going great. Feeling like a champ. Powering
in
through.
In your closet?
Yeah, feeling like a champ in the closet. I guess, yeah, no. Way to cut me down to size, Allie.
Never my intention. You get all those fun costumes and... I occasionally get the rumbling of a Mack truck, so it all evens out, I think.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So, I know I said many times that skin books are my first love, and I'm still pulling for that to end up on some kind of merchandise. And they do hold a special place in my heart, but for me, I really think it's witch trials. Witch trials have always been there for me, and I am so excited to be getting back into them, so to speak, with this episode.
You really never forget your first love.
I don't. I also never forget my 8th grade English teacher who told me that I would never be able to make a career out of witches.
Ha.
Look at me now.
Ha. Jokes on you, English teachers mm-hmm. of America. Mm-hmm. No, we love English teachers here. Not that
we
one.
We do.
But
we love and support English teachers.
Worldwide.
Just... You know, I couldn't get commas or diagramming sentences, so I don't know. Not my
but
middle school is never
sure
a fun
got
time
witches.
For anyone. I sure got witches. I always have witches to come back to, and they will never judge me for not knowing when to use a semicolon.
Because they're too busy being on fire.
Well, that got dark quick.
Anyway,
welcome to
Behind the Lore.
So, was there anything, we covered a lot in this episode, was there anything that you were surprised to learn when you were doing the research? You have a pretty hefty background in folklore and magic and just generally kind of a witchy vibe. So, I'm curious what was familiar to you and what was brand spanking new, if anything was.
Yeah, so I was really sort of surprised by and interested by some of the political dynamics that were revealed in this episode. Where I guess kind of the motives behind witchcraft trials varied when the trials were for men versus for women. Mm-hmm. And I guess sort of some of the national and religious structures that led to that gender differentiation was really interesting to me. And I hadn't been aware of in the past.
Yeah, I love digging into how different cultures handle witch trials. And we've looked at a ton of English and Scottish trials over the many, many years we've been doing lore. And I remember my first episode, my test episode for Aaron was researching an Italian trial. But we kind of got out of our comfort zone with this one, I think. It was very different for me to read about. I learned a ton of new stuff. So I was really enjoying that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, witch trials aren't about witches. They're about power. And mm-hmm. so it was really interesting to explore how that power manifested in different time periods and different spaces to be wielded as this tool, or for the witch trials to be wielded as this tool in order to claim and maintain power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we start off on a bit of familiar ground with the Ursula Kemp trial. This is something that we've seen many times played out in many episodes, but one of the things that was unique is that her child is brought into it. And I always wonder about the children in these trial documents, and this Kemp trial got me thinking about it all over again. We did an episode about little Jeanette Device a few years ago now, I think, and the Pendleton trials, I believe. And here we have Ursula's 8-year-old son, Thomas, who is giving some pretty damning testimony against his mom. why do you think he did that? I don't think there was anything that specifically said we gave him candy and told him what to say, but was it bribery, trickery, or did he just not really understand the gravity of what was happening?
Yeah, so this is pretty heartbreaking, really, and because his testimony ended up essentially being the most damning piece of testimony that led to his mother's execution. And I really do think he just didn't understand the implications of what he was doing. I believe he was 8 years old. And, you know, children are incredibly imaginative in that time. And there is this blurring between fantasy world and reality. And I'm sure that the witness was led. I'm sure that he was encouraged to say what he said. And I really do not think he understood why he really couldn't say that. Specifically, he said his mother has four spirits that come to her at night and suck the blood of her arms and in other places on her body, which, yeah, was incredibly damning evidence against her. And, yeah, I kind of shrivel up to think about what that child felt when he grew up and understood what he had done.
Yeah. No, that would be a hard thing to live with, in my opinion. I don't know what I would do in that situation, especially as an adult and, you know, recognizing what had happened. Like,
well, and it clearly wasn't his fault. You know, he was a child who was led into it. But yeah, I really just think he didn't understand the severity of the claims that he was making.
Yeah. The Kemp trial, as we go over, it really sets up kind of how witch trials are handled going forward, because this is right when things are kind of starting to ramp up late in Elizabeth's reign. But we get to Normandy around the same time, and this is where we kind of start drawing the lines in this episode. There was a trial in Normandy between 1564 and 1660. Can you tell us a bit about that trial and why it was so different, why it was so interesting?
Yeah, so there is this quote that I found in my research that talks about, you know, the typical Normandy witch trial, in which it says, in Normandy, the archetypal witch was not an old woman, but a shepherd who might either be an old man or a teenager. The most feared witch's spells were likely to involve toad venom, and the most powerful witch's magic performed was with stolen Eucharists.
Huh.
So, yeah, it was this very different direction as to who was being accused of witchcraft, and it was these male shepherds as opposed to, you know, women who owned land or whatever we're used to hearing.
Yeah, you pointed out in your research that 70% of the known defendants from this trial were men.
Mm-hmm.
And 28 of 59, about half of the men who were accused, were shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think they were doing? Like, what could you come up with toad venom and the Eucharist? We've talked a bit about the Eucharist being used, particularly in love magic, a couple episodes ago, back in February. But this kind of seems like a bizarre combination to me.
I mean, I'm skeptical as to whether they were using toad venom and Eucharists at all. You know, like, I don't think they were really doing anything with either of those. Shepherds, of course, were working class. They probably followed the older folk religions and practices. And so they were the same kinds of people that the church had targeted for centuries. The church's enemies were anyone who was, you know, following a religion other than their own, following a belief system other than their own, as well as those in power are always out to get the working class. And so, you know, I would say that these shepherds were like any other poor people who have been pressed down by the powers that be, or people whose belief and knowledge rival that of the church, turned into scapegoats.
Yeah.
Or Should I say scape sheep?
We love a good pun in this house. We
yeah, I've been
one of these
to
days we're
going to
get Harry on an episode. It will be entirely puns on that day.
It will
nothing
end
but
you.
Puns.
Harry is the pun king.
He is, and we respect it. I probably would not be able to get through half of the cabinet scripts without the puns that he throws around so liberally.
They're devastating.
And we love that for us.
Truly,
they are. So we move on from England and Normandy, where we're a little more familiar, into witch trials in Russia and the Russian Empire. Now, I didn't know too much about Russia's culture or religious struggles before reading through the script and your research. Was this a topic that you were more familiar with, or was this like a totally new experience? I know with your new book, some of it was set in Russia, although the focus and the time period aren't quite the same. But I was wondering if you kind of had a little bit of crossover in your research.
Why, yes, Allie. Funny you should mention my new novel, Thistlefoot, a story based in Russian folklore, Jewish history, and American road trip narratives reimagining the Baba Yaga. Eh?
You good with your spiel?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Listen, yes.
10 out of 10 recommend it. I really enjoyed reading it, so.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, so I'm losing my mind this week because someone got a Thistlefoot tattoo. Like, a stranger got a tattoo based on my book, and I don't even know how to exist in the world anymore. So this is a big new benchmark for me as an author.
Yeah.
Unrelated to this episode of Lore, which has nothing to do with my book. Anyway, yeah, so I would say this particular subset of Russian history had nothing to do with the research that I did for Thistlefoot, which is set in 1919 during the pogroms. I was mostly researching Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found really interesting about this particular period in Russian history and its relationship to witchcraft was how Russia's isolation from the Reformation impacted its handling of witch trials. So essentially, in other parts of Europe, in the parts of Europe that we're more familiar with hearing witch trials from, the purpose of a witch trial essentially was a theological one. It was about the church trying to tamp down and counteract threatening alternate belief systems and threatening alternate sources of power. So, you know, that's why we hear about these women who were healers, for example, being attacked by the church. If you can prove to the church that you can heal someone with a means other than God, then you have power over the church.
Right.
However, in Russia, the Reformation had not quite touched them yet. And so it did not have these broad, sweeping theological implications. Instead, witch trials were just like regular criminal cases. You got to remember, like, people believed in magic as a literal concrete thing, as concrete as like stealing
toast.
Yeah, as any other crime, as literal as stealing or as literal as murder or as literal as any other petty crime or felony. And so it was treated just like any other petty crime or felony. And rather than being sort of a sin or a threat to one's immortal soul, it was just like, this person did a crime, and so they will be treated as if they did a crime.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting, because that aspect of the mentality between Russia and the rest of Europe's witch trials is fairly similar. You know, it had more of a religious bent in other trials that we were looking at rather than solely criminal. But it's so interesting that the Russian trials are so male focused, because there have been a number of sources that I've read, like Anne Barstow's Witch Craze, that has earmarked the female focus of witch trials as a key part of them. Like, it's not a witch trial if it isn't focused on women, and that witch hunting was actually woman hunting. So kind of, I guess, how would you account for these differences in mentality between the male-focused trials and female-focused trials?
I would say that the difference is what witchcraft represented in each case. Because remember, you know, a witchcraft trial is not about witchcraft, it's about power. And so right. male witch trials represented a battle, often between the old world and the new, as we see in, I think, some of the Norwegian or Icelandic cases, the Scandinavian ones. It was also a way for two men, both in power, to have a power dispute with each other, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, female witch trials were about scapegoating and villainizing a marginalized community, which was not quite the same as a power dispute between two prominent men in a community. So
right.
both of these categories are about power, but the question was, you know, the question that determined whether it would be aimed at a man or a woman is like, who has the power that the law found threatening at any given time? And, you know, what power is being attempted to be taken away?
Okay. And did you notice, like, a big difference between the types of charges that are typically brought against women and the ones that were being brought against men? Usually we see sex with the devil and some kind of familiar and illness and dead crops and dead babies and things that we're a little more used to, most of which come from books like the Malleus Maleficarum. But what did you kind of see for the charges against the men? We know why they're being leveled, but right. you never actually say why in the charge. Like, they
sure,
would never say it's because you're getting more important than me, and I don't like that.
Yeah, exactly. So honestly, I didn't see a massive difference. Like, yes, there is a lack of these sexual aspects, like sex with the devil kind of stuff. That was definitely reserved for the women. Yay, ladies.
Woohoo.
But
lucky us.
I know, sounds like a blast. but with the men, honestly, they were often accused, like women, of bewitching others into illness. That was the most common one that I saw. So they were, you know, someone in the town would get sick, and then it would be assumed that a witch did it, and they would find the witch who was responsible. And you see that in male and in female witch trials pretty ubiquitously, I think. So they didn't stand out to me as, I guess what was interesting is that the concept of the witch trial sort of felt the same across the board. And what really changed was the reason why that tool was being wielded.
So kind of skipping through the trial itself and the kind of bizarre focus on hernias that they had going on there. For most witch trials that we've seen, the choice of execution was hanging, strangulation, or sometimes garrotting, and then the remains would often be burnt. We don't usually see actual live burning, but Russia takes a different approach, and our victim was beheaded. Do you know if there was any reason for that choice? I know in England, beheading was usually reserved for nobility because it was quick. It was relatively painless if the executioner knew what they were doing. But did it have any kind of significance, or was it just the easiest option?
You know, I honestly don't know why they chose beheading. I was not able to find that. It didn't say that in the source documents. I was reading for this piece a firsthand account, basically, written by the examiner. It was pretty creepy to read. It was written by the investigator, the witchcraft investigator who was sent over.
Oh, Jesus.
And so he was reporting back to his higher-ups what he had discovered and how he had punished everyone and how he had tortured everyone. It was real messed up. But he didn't say why they were beheaded specifically. My guess, personally, as to why they were not executed in the way that we typically see witches be executed in other parts of Europe, is likely the same reason that we see the other differences in this trial, in that, you know, it was sealed off from the Reformation. It was not being treated as a separate kind of case than any other criminal case. And so, therefore, the execution was not a special witch-style execution. It was just an execution.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And you noted that Malikarov was not the only one who was accused, but when he was accused and tortured, he named his wife, I believe her name was Olenka, as well, and kind of took her down with him. And her execution, I would argue, was more gruesome. What, we don't hear much about her in the episode. What happened to her?
Yeah, this part's a bummer. I mean, the whole thing's a bummer, but...
The whole thing's a giant bummer.
Yeah, big bummer. So, yeah, essentially, Malikarov was tortured three times. He had three rounds of severe torture, and I believe it was in the third round of torture that he admitted to being... Or he admitted to bewitching specific women who were in the town who were sick, and he listed their names, and then he implicated other supposed witches who had worked with him, and one of those people he implicated was indeed his wife, Olenka. So then they brought Olenka in, they tortured her, and she admitted as well to bewitching people with her husband. So as we know, you know, interrogation under torture does not exactly yield the most reliable results, but...
That usually doesn't matter in witch trials.
Exactly. And at the end of the interrogations, Romanchyakov, I'm not sure how to pronounce that name, but that's the examiner that,
right.
whose account I was reading. He decided that three of the men in this case, including Malikarov, would be beheaded, and then Olenka would also be executed, but she would be buried alive, presumably up to her neck, and then left there to die. This was actually the most common punishment at the time for female criminals, which, you know, I find really insidious because you see punishments like this in different parts of Europe at that time aimed at women, where rather than being executed, they are basically immured and abandoned. Vestal virgins, for example, were killed in a similar way because it was such a terrible sin to kill one. This way, the people could say, oh, we didn't kill Olenka. We didn't kill this woman. We just put her in a hole. You know, so
and
the burden
she died.
Of,
it was so weird.
She died. Yeah, I know. How did that happen? So basically, it absolves people the burden of guilt of murdering a woman. But in reality, it is an excruciatingly worse death than those allotted to the men in this same trial.
Yeah. Somehow, even in this trial that is so male-focused, the women still end up with the short end of the stick.
Ain't that just the way?
So we move from witches in Russia to witches in Iceland. And one thing I found really interesting is that Britain and Russia kind of had a very different conversion process to Christianity than many Scandinavian countries. And you mentioned in the episode that magic seems to be kind of more of a neutral thing for them than anything outright malevolent. Do you think that was, why do you think that was, and did it make the conversion to Christianity more difficult? Like, it seemed very easy to either usurp magical practices or folk practices or make them totally evil once Christianity had enough of a foothold. But that does, I don't really see that happening here in Iceland.
Yeah, so the way that Icelandic folk belief, or magical belief rather, functioned was just as like a standard, everyday, kind of banal folk practice in many ways. So people had sigils that would help their butter be soft enough and help their sheep be healthy. And they weren't used against people necessarily. They were just kind of like everyday typical tools that were used in daily life. And so I think in part because of that, it made it people didn't get that it would be a threat to Christianity. They're like, this has nothing to do with religion. This has nothing to do with this new strange theology that's come in. This is just like part of our farm work, you know? And so there was this odd clash in the understanding or an odd clash in what magic was considered to even be. Mm. Where the Christians coming in were viewing this old folk practice as kind of this demonic opposition to their God, while
right.
the people of Iceland were kind of like, no, this has nothing to do with that, really. Like, this has nothing to do with God. This has to do with, like, the quality of my butter.
God is not in my butter, and yeah. neither is the devil.
Exactly. And so
I made this, damn it.
Yeah. And so in certain ways, I think it made it harder for the Christians to usurp the old folk religions because they were so deeply integrated into people's mm-hmm. daily lives and belief systems. But in other ways, I imagine it kind of would have made it easier, too, because they weren't mutually exclusive. Or at least
right.
the people didn't see them as mutually exclusive. But yeah, there was just this very large divide between the people's opinion of witchcraft and the government or clergy's opinion of witchcraft.
Which ends up getting a little messy, as we see. But one thing that I found really interesting in these Icelandic trials is that books of magic were so common. We know that grimoires kind of existed in Western culture, but, you know, a lot of them were owned by wealthy, educated men who were using them more for study and philosophy and theory, like John Dee in Elizabeth I's court, rather than any kind of practical application. Do you think that was kind of the case here, where they had these books to learn from them rather than use any of the ceremonies in them? Or was there just more widespread literacy in Iceland than in other European countries?
There was a lot of literacy in Iceland. Story in Iceland is a hugely important cultural institution and has been mm. for thousands of years. And, you know, in the long, long winters in Iceland, one of the ways that families would pass the time is they would all be in this one small room that they shared for heat, and they would read to each other at night.
Mm-hmm.
Not from magical books, but from, you know, just they would read to each other at night, and they would have these nightly right. stories. So, yeah, literacy was a hugely important part of Icelandic culture, even among the poorer classes.
Mm.
And, you know, when we look at who possessed these magic books and who were using these magic books, women really didn't have those books. So basically, one of the reasons that women were not so commonly accused and convicted of witchcraft in Iceland is because they didn't have the books. The men had the books. So they couldn't be proven guilty if they didn't have the books. In Iceland, witchcraft was a man's game because the men, being a patriarchal society, were more powerful and more educated than the women, and they were the ones who were reading the stories every night to people, and so they would have been the ones who had more access to the books and to literacy in general than women would have, which ended up being damning for them when mm. the Christians came in and were like, hey, you have that magic book. You must be a witch.
And it's all downhill from there. So we kind of round things out by going back to an old favorite, and I've already mentioned it a little bit in the episode, the Malleus Maleficarum. And one of the things we end on that I thought was really interesting was that the Malleus might have had fewer gendered connotations than we initially thought. Why do you think so many accusations, especially in Germanic territories and in England and Scotland, primarily fell on women rather than men, if the language was considered more gender neutral at the time?
Again, I think it's best to think of witch trials as a tool. They're a weapon. Mm. You know, they're a weapon like any weapon. So if we think of witch trials as being like a gun, in the hands of the Icelandic Christians, this gun was used to shoot down the old world religion. And that involved aiming it at men. In Europe's patriarchal societies, where these patriarchal leaders got their hands on that same gun, they used it to maintain the patriarchy. And they found it incredibly efficient at doing so, and so continued in that same vein. So I really do believe that witch trials are just this tool, just this weapon, this gun, and it is aimed at whoever seems to be the greatest threat at any given time. And yeah, and because of these patriarchal systems that rely so heavily on maintaining their patriarchy in order to maintain ultimate power, women were, in those instances, the largest threat, and therefore ended up on the other end of that gun.
Mm. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed reading through your research and listening to this episode. I hope everybody else did too, and I hope you guys enjoyed our conversation today. We will see you again in 2 weeks, I think. Thanks, everybody.
See you soon.
And that does it for today's episode of Behind the Lore. Many thanks to Jenna Rose for chatting with me today. A lot of folks don't know this, but Lore is actually part of a larger network of shows called Grim and Mild, and you can learn more about those shows and everything else going on over at one central place, grimandmild.com. On behalf of the entire Lore team, thank you for your constant and generous support, and for letting us tell you our stories. And until next time, thanks for listening.